Welcome to The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina Vega. This week, we're revisiting some of my favorite conversations I've had while filling in as a guest host on this show. And today, we start with a very important conversation I had about the mental health of teenagers and how it suffered due to the pandemic. Listen up. The fear, loss, stress, and isolation of the pandemic has been extraordinarily challenging for our collective mental health. And this is particularly true for teens and adolescents.
Although you would expect it to be less stressful because you'd have more time to do homework, somehow I feel like teachers have been compensating by giving us more work.
For me, homeschooling has been really difficult. I've had a really hard time focusing. I've been handing assignments late. I've been texting my friends during class. It's really quite awful.
Now there have been complaints about too much screen time at my school. So they're cutting class time down, and they're dishing out more homework, which isn't great.
These are the voices of teens talking with the women's interest website, SheKnows.com, back in April of 2020, when schools had only been closed for about a month. So nearly 18 months later, the isolation and uncertainty of the pandemic, combined with the pressures to achieve and perform well during the past year, has heightened anxiety, depression, and thoughts of self-harm among teens. A recent op-ed in the New York Times reviews startling results from multiple studies showing that the mental wellness of adolescents has deteriorated significantly. And as students return to in-person classes in the fall, reporting from the Hechinger Report shows that many schools are ill-equipped to handle the decline in mental health. Joining me now is Kate Ricks, Oakland-based freelance writer with the Hechinger Report. Kate, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. Nice to talk to you, Melissa.
And also joining me is Emily Esfani-Smith, who is a doctoral candidate in clinical psychology and the author of The Power of Meaning. Emily, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
So Emily, can you walk us through a bit what the pandemic has meant for the mental health of teens?
So the sad facts are that there was already a mental health crisis among teenagers and adolescents even before the pandemic. Over the last decade, we've seen rates of anxiety, depression, self-harm, suicidal thinking rising fairly dramatically among this group of teenagers. And what happened during the pandemic is that all of those trends accelerated. And the question is why? And you know, many teens are suffering, as we heard their voices earlier. They feel very anxious, in particular about academic goals and the pressure to achieve, which strangely has accelerated over the past 16 months. You'd have thought that the pressure would have been alleviated, but that's not what's happened. And that's been a chief cause of their mental health concerns.
It seems to be that part of what's happening in our public discourse right now is this idea that, don't worry, everything will be fine when we go back to normal. But Kate, in your recent reporting, you found that schools aren't necessarily ready to manage this mental health crisis, this increased stress that Emily was just talking about.
That's right, Melissa. What Emily was just saying about teens feeling this pressure to continue to sort of achieve under these very difficult circumstances only highlights the fact that the need for on-site mental health counseling services in public schools, because a lot of times teenagers are in some school districts, like the one where I live in Oakland, California, there are actually school-based health centers where social workers are present and teens can just walk in and make an appointment to talk to someone, and it's confidential. So if, for example, their parents are a cause of stress in their life, perhaps putting pressure on them that they can't quite meet, the counseling is there for them and they don't have to ask their parents for help finding counseling. So that, to me, the pandemic, what I found was that the pandemic has, as Emily said, only highlighted how ill-equipped our schools are to meet the need. Because, you know, I heard from a psychologist in Chicago Public Schools who said that he's responsible for 4,600 students in his school. He's the only psychologist who works in that school. And they said, you know, he said, I feel like I'm doing triage.
Kate, talk to me a little bit more about that sense of students feeling like they don't have the support systems that they need.
The teens that I spoke with, were many of them were actually, you know, teens who you would think would be aware of whatever supports their schools had. The teens that I spoke with included a student vice president in Las Vegas who was unfortunately, you know, lost friends during the pandemic to actually drug overdoses. And this teenager was, you know, informed that their friend had passed away. And then there was really nothing that the school could do to support. There wasn't the staff available to provide grief counseling for students who had lost friends. And this teenager in particular, Caden McKnight, who I quote, wasn't even aware that there are some apps. For example, the district had put in place some apps to help students monitor their mental health that would trigger staff at the district level if that teen reported feeling that they needed help. The teen, you know, Caden wasn't aware that these services existed. So I think that there was a sense that the services are overburdened and stretched, but also the communication to teens themselves about what's available to them during the pandemic were not adequate. And so while districts were aware, the people that I spoke with, definitely aware of the need and doing, in some cases, scrambling to put things together, the communications weren't really in place. And so I heard from multiple students reports of that they didn't know who they would even reach out to if they wanted to talk to someone.
And yet, Emily, they were getting some kind of communication, and the communication they seemed to be getting was, no matter how bad it is, you still got to achieve, you still got to accomplish, you've got to get into these colleges, you've got to get these top grades. How is it that we were failing as communities, as schools, to communicate the resources available, but we're still communicating so much pressure?
It's a great question, and it's kind of a tragic reality. I think, you know, at the bottom of it is the good intentions of teachers and of parents. A lot of people were, you know, thinking about students over the past 16, 17 months, were worried about a year of lost learning, lost milestones. And I can see, with that fear in the background, wanting to encourage students, pressure students to push themselves to continue getting good grades, being involved in extracurricular activities, perhaps in an online format, things like that. But what's really striking is that, you know, students reported in a national survey conducted by the organization Challenge Success that their parents, their expectations during the pandemic didn't, for many of them, their expectations remained the same as before the pandemic. And for many of those parents, their expectations actually increased. And so, even though the parents had a sense that their children were struggling, there was still this demand to perform that was placed on them. And that was very difficult for students. Other research showed that one of the chief predictors of student depression and anxiety during the pandemic was parents' unrealistic expectations placed on their children, and parental criticism as well. And I think part of why we saw that accelerating was simply because parents and kids were spending more time in the home together. And so parents were more likely to kind of be there on top of their children, making sure that they weren't, you know, looking over their shoulders on their laptops, making sure that they weren't, you know, on social media instead of paying attention in class, things like that. So there was this kind of toxic brew of parental criticism, unrealistic expectations, and students lacking the sort of autonomy that they would have had under ordinary circumstances, being at school away from the household.
Yeah, I certainly said to girlfriends more than a few times that nature did not intend for us to be 24 hours a day in the house with our teens. Like, there's just no way that is good for either the parents or the kids, right? That need for autonomy and development. But Emily, just quick second on this. Isn't that also in part that we tend to discount teens' feelings? We're like, well, yes, they're emotional, but that's just kind of how teens feel, as opposed to really acknowledging how troubling this time was.
I think that's right. I think that there is this idea that, you know, teenage years are hormonal years, they're difficult years, and the parent's job is to, you know, keep their anchors and keels steady and move them through this period. ensuring that they're achieving the important milestones and goals like academic goals. But of course, I think what we need to remember is that the pandemic was a national and collective stressor, a trauma. You know, as Kate shows in her reporting, many of these students lost their friends to suicide, to drug overdoses, and to dismiss the grief and all of the loss that's arisen over the past 17 years as just the normal emotional upheaval of the teenage period, I think is to do teens a real disservice. And in speaking to them, I've seen a real craving and yearning to have some sort of space and forum, whether it's at home or at school, to process their grief and these losses.
Kate Ricks is an Oakland-based freelance writer with the Hechinger Report, and Emily Esafani-Smith is a doctoral student in clinical psychology and the author of The Power of Meaning. I also just want to note that if you have a teen who is suffering, or if you know a young person struggling right now, please call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline number. It's 1-800-273-8255. Or the crisis text line, text HELLO, H-E-L-L-O, to 741741. 741741. We've been hearing about the toll the pandemic has taken on teens' mental health, and we're going to stick with mental health in the next conversation about how a tennis star prioritized her own well-being over the French Open. Now, back in May, tennis superstar Naomi Osaka decided to exit the French Open. Osaka had previously announced she would not be participating in post-match press conferences at the tournament, citing mental health concerns. After her first-round win, French Open organizers fined Osaka $15,000 for skipping her press conference. Osaka was also warned by organizers of the four Grand Slam tennis tournaments that she risked a complete suspension from the French Open for refusing to speak with the media. Following the news that she was leaving the tournament altogether, several prominent athletes expressed their support, including Steph Curry, Russell Wilson, and Serena Williams, who is not going to the Olympics.
I feel for Naomi. I feel like I wish I could give her a hug because I know what it's like. Like I said, I've been in those positions. We have different personalities, and people are different. Not everyone is the same. I'm thick, you know, other people are thin. So everyone is different and everyone handles things differently. So, you know, you just have to let her handle it the way she wants to in the best way that she thinks she can.
But other current and former tennis pros have been more critical of Osaka's choice not to speak with the press. Osaka's announcement and the range of reactions it has received are part of a much longer history of Black athletes questioning what they really owe to predominantly white reporters. Last week, Osaka used her Instagram account to link to another notable example, running back Marshawn Lynch speaking, or rather not speaking, to reporters in 2015.
Hey, I'm just here so I don't get fined. So y'all can sit here and ask me all the questions y'all want to. I'm going to answer with the same answer, so y'all can shoot if y'all please. I'm here so I won't get fined. I'm here so I won't get fined. I'm here so I won't get fined.
For more, I'm now joined by Amira Rose Davis, Assistant Professor of History and African American Studies at Penn State and co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast. It's great to have you here, Amira.
Yeah, great to be back.
And also with us, Dr. Caroline Brackett, who's Assistant Dean and Associate Professor at Mercer University's College of Health Professions. She's also a licensed professional counselor. Dr. Brackett, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you for having me.
Amira, I want to start with you. Can you just walk us through the timeline a little bit? How do we go from Osaka's announcement last week that she was just going to not speak with the press at the French Open to her choice to actually exit the tournament entirely?
Yeah, so last week she put out a preemptive statement saying, heads up, I'm not going to do this for my own mental health. I know I'll get fined. I hope that they use the fine towards mental health initiatives and support. And that was that. The immediate response to that was swift and varied critique, suggestions that she should woman up, that this was part of, you know, her duties as an athlete. And then the one most significant second response was not just the fine that she received after her first round win and she didn't do the presser, but all four slams, that's the Australian Open, the French Open, Wimbledon, and the US Open, coming together to issue a joint statement both to her and publicly, that the first few lines said, we stand by her, we're going to support her mental health, et cetera, and then very quickly turned to, but just also so you know, not only will we continue to fine you, but these fines can escalate, and also you could be in danger of, we will default you from the tournament, we will remove you from the tournament. Naomi's response to that was to issue another statement via her social media to say, I don't want to be a distraction. I was trying to get ahead of it. She disclosed her own mental health concerns in more detail. She offered up that she's been battling depression and anxiety. And then she said the best thing for her to do was to withdraw completely in protection of her mental health and really kind of pushing back by refusal, by saying no at being kind of forced or kind of strong-armed by the slams into participation. And that's where we are now, where we see a number of conversations again occurring on the heels of her decision.
So Dr. Brackett, I want to come to you on this, because that idea of protecting the mental health, it certainly seems to me, if she said, I have a sore elbow, I have a torn muscle, I have a twisted ankle, and therefore I'm not going to compete, then everyone would be fine with that, because the protection of the physical health is considered acceptable, reasonable, and real. But that saying I have emotional or mental health that needs, you know, a little protection as well, sort of elicits this kind of pushback.
Yes, I think that it raises a bigger issue in the disparity that we see in the way people treat mental health conditions versus physical conditions. When someone is experiencing issues related to depression or anxiety, you often want them to do things that are going to alleviate symptoms and to focus on their self-care. And when a person reaches out or expresses that they're going to do that, they're experiencing some backlash. I think that it's important to recognize that if a person is saying, this is what I need to perform at my best, but also for myself, my own mental wellness, that we respect that. And as a college administrator, but also someone who worked with students with disabilities and mental health is covered under, in the United States, the Americans with Disabilities Act. And there's a process of accommodating those disabilities. And so mental health is one of those. And I think we just need to take a step back and recognize that there are times when we're putting too much pressure on people to be what we want them to be, and not giving them that space to do what they need to do when it's in their best interest.
And I'll say, maybe not just us and not just we, but maybe specifically media. Let's take a listen to Osaka at a Wimbledon press conference back in 2019.
When you play someone who you lost to so recently, how hard is it not to have that in your head?
It's, how hard is it not to have that in my head? Very hard. I don't know how to answer that.
Amira, listening to her respond to that question back in 2019, it seems it's pretty easy to hear kind of how difficult that is for her. I'm wondering, like, are reporters really just the most awful? I mean, and I don't mean that in a joking way, but like quite seriously, it's pretty painful to have to live your good and your bad in such a public space.
Yeah, precisely. I mean, I think there's three different things in operation here, but first off the bat, absolutely. Naomi has been talking about this and gesturing to this for a while. She's very introverted, and that is very clear. You know, leading up to this, the narratives around her being really bad on clay, and was she worried about, you know, getting another first round defeat because she's bad on the surface, like certainly was really heavy on her. I think that, you know, there's some particulars around here about sports media and the role of the journalist. And, you know, you're right. You know, we're academics. Like, when I get a fellowship rejection, 5 minutes later, I'm not sitting in front of you know, people right. telling them what I did wrong and, you know, how I'm thinking about it. And
how
so
did
I think
that revise and resubmit feel?
Right, exactly, exactly. And so I think that there, you know, one of the conversations that is being had, of course, is what is the function of this presser? What is required of athletes? And I think Naomi is part of a kind of growing, you know, cadre of athletes who are pushing back and saying, you know, you have access to our bodies, you have our weight, you have our height, you have our injury history, you have all these things, and then you also feel entitled to have all of our minds at on your terms, at, you know, when you require them. And particularly Black athletes who are pairing this with, you know, their right to protest, are pairing this with conversations about fan abuse that they are dealing with, and they're saying, hey, they're using their shifting power and their own presence on social media to push back and say, this, we shouldn't have to accept this at our place of employment. We shouldn't just have to grin and bear it. We shouldn't just have to go along with it because that's what you do. And you, you know, may have bought a ticket to the circuits, but we don't have to be your clowns. And this is where we're drawing the line on our labor. And she's also absolutely part of that conversation because you can hear in that clip, you know, her, you know, how she's feeling about it. But you have all these other instances with Naomi where she's pushing back or trying to reframe the kind of questions she's getting. And I think that points to one of the issues. No, journalism's like, oh, they're not just the worst, but there is a particular recycling of narratives. When she says in her letter, in her statement, that she's had depression since the U.S. Open in 2018, which was, of course, her and Serena and that big hullabaloo, that gets brought up every time they play each other, every time she goes to the U.S. Open, every time, you know, she thinks about it. And this regurgitation is part of what she's pointing to.
Listen, first of all, I'm about to get a t-shirt that says, you may have bought a ticket to the circus, but I don't have to be your clown. And I'm going to wear it every day. I really appreciate that framing. And Dr. Brackett, I want to come to you on that in part because earlier we heard in the clip, Serena Williams saying, you know, people deal with things differently. I'm thick, she's thin. And I don't think she meant that as a dig, but rather just as descriptive. But I also kept thinking, yeah, she's also two decades younger. Like, I think Serena's desire to give her a hug is in part that sense of, like, she's very young still and coming through this process. Given the work that you do with young people at exactly this age, what are some of the challenges for having to manage failure or those kinds of repeated re-traumas in such a public way?
Yeah, I think that that's important to look at. And when you look at the age that she's in, she's still in that identity development stage in her life and hearing messages from people and the media are not going to help when they're negative towards her. And that's not to say that, you know, as an athlete that you're not going to face some criticism. But I do think that it's important for one, you know, she's using her voice. And when she starts to use her voice, then she can control her narrative. And it's important to think about when people are asking you questions, they're asking questions to write the story that they want to write about you. And so you do lose some of that control that you have when you're sitting in those press conferences. And I do think that it's important, you know, one of the things that she said in her statement is that she reached out to the tournament to, you know, talk to them after the tournament because of the pressure that she was feeling during the time that she was playing, but also being open to having some communication about how can we make this better for the athletes, for the fans, for the press. And I think that that's an important consideration, you know, systemically. How do you, or how do they work together? That's the tournament, the athletes, the press, to create a system that works for all. And that's not saying that you're going to give athletes a pass, but taking into consideration the person, you know, we need to have that person first language. There are people who play professional sports. And so putting the person back into what they're doing.
And that idea of person first is also, it feels to me, Amira, connected to, you know, important identities, right? So she's young, she's a star, she's well paid. She's also a Black woman, you know, barely out of being a Black girl. And it does feel to me like our, you know, our public willingness to accept no is gendered, So boys and men are much more able to be like, nope, not gonna do it. But when women say no, whew, that's a whole nother kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering how much of this feels intersectional, race and gendered to you, Amira.
Bound up together. But I think that there's, you know, I think that that last point about how she indicated in her statement that she wants to work with the SLAMs and really underscore this moving forward is really important, because it's also her recognizing that while she is bound up in these very familiar kind of the double bind of being Black and a woman, she's also well paid. She's also at the top of the sport. And there are people on the tour who are suffering mental health concerns that can't eat a $15,000 fine. There are people who cannot afford to withdraw from a circuit. And so her, this is a continuation of her using her platform. But I think more importantly, you know, I heard a bit about the earlier segment, which was so important to talk about the mental health concerns of Black girls who are often overlooked, and all the ways that like myths of strong, superwoman, you know, Black girl magic is really creating mental health concerns, especially around depression and anxiety for Black girls and Black women. And the times where we really get to have these conversations, when Meghan Markle, you know, talks about it, when Naomi Osaka talks about it. So that visibility of this conversation bound up in being a Black woman is also a really, it's the condition of how it's received, as well as what she has to put out to the world.
Amira Rose Davis is an assistant professor of history and African American studies at Penn State, and Dr. Caroline Brackett is an assistant dean and associate professor at Mercer University's College of Health Professions. Thank you so much to both of you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for having me today.
Hi, I'm Helga Davis. On my show, I speak with artists and thinkers about how to uncover the extraordinary in everyday life. People like musicians Brittany Howard and Sampha, Broadway director Whitney White, scholar Noli Way Rooks, and playwright Suzanne Laurie Parks. These are fearless conversations where we don't just meet each other, we meet ourselves. Join us. Listen to Helga wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. It's been 6 years since the NFL reached a $1 billion settlement in response to retired players connecting traumatic brain injuries suffered during play to long-term loss of cognitive function.
Well, it's something that we thought was important to do because we want to make sure that the players who may need help, may need assistance, or their families get that as soon as possible. Rather than litigating this for years and years, we have a fund that's available based on need.
That was NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell speaking about the settlement on CBS in 2015. The U.S. Supreme Court then paved the way for the settlement in 2016, refusing to hear a challenge to a lower court's decision on the agreement. And in that settlement, the NFL did not actually admit guilt for its role in the players' brain injuries. But last month, the NFL admitted it is guilty of something else, a practice known as race norming. Race norming means the league determined eligibility for settlement dollars based in part on the race of the player. Using a decades-old medical practice, the NFL asserted that Black players typically had lower cognitive function than their white counterparts. In short, race norming made it harder for Black players to qualify for a payout if they have dementia. Now the NFL says it's reevaluating all prior claims made under the concussion settlement. In a statement put out by the league, a spokesperson said, quote, "Everyone agrees race-based norms should be replaced, but no off-the-shelf alternative exists, and that's why these experts are working to solve this decades-old issue." Former running back and current Detroit Lions assistant head coach, Deuce Staley, weighed in on the news with reporters in early June.
Yeah, it's two parts that I think about when it comes to this. First is insulting, very insulting, for that to even be going on. And then the second part is now the NFL is correcting themselves. You know, with the first part, without being corrected, you still have a problem. But now I guess they're coming out and saying, okay, you know, this was wrong, this, that, and other, and they're correcting it now, which that's what you want.
But other former players are more skeptical that the NFL is ready to hold itself accountable for the racially biased practice. For more on what the recent decision made by the NFL means for Black players, I spoke with Ken Jenkins, a former Washington running back, and Mary Claire Dale, legal affairs writer for the Associated Press and 2018 Nieman Fellow at Harvard.
I think what's interesting is that it was developed in medicine, specifically in neurocognitive medicine, in the early 1990s, with the goal of really capturing more people who might need treatment. So when people take dementia tests, which often include several hours of testing under many different types of skills, memory, language, executive function, et cetera, the scores can be normed by both gender, education, and in this case, race. Again, in medicine, it was intended to offer more people treatment that might need it and whose scores may not have suggested that they had some cognitive disabilities. But here in this case, instead of looking at people holistically, they were using it to look at the scores to determine a legal award, which even medical ethicists and doctors say was never the intention of how these norms were designed to be used.
And yet, Mr. Jenkins, it's not as though the NFL looked at itself, its own practices, and was like, oh, this is terrible. We should stop. What did it take to actually bring this to light and to move this towards ending the practice?
You know, it took the efforts of the wives who actually have to manage their household and their families while they watch their husbands steadily and slowly decline, the men that they knew to be these vibrant human beings. And it took a petition of 50,000 signatures to shed light on the subject and the practice. And that's what really moved the needle. There were lawyers who actually have been working on this for 3 or 4 years and could get no movement at all. But once the public outcry got to be loud enough, they changed their story.
As a former player, and particularly I'm thinking about your wife and the other wives and partners who, as you point out, are managing the realities of these traumatic head injuries and of the following cognitive issues that come along with it. How are y'all kind of feeling about the NFL in this moment?
Well, we understand that the NFL owns Sunday, and the NFL is mega powerful, smart lawyers, expensive lawyers, and we realize that we're David and Goliath here, us being David, obviously. And so we feel like we've gotten some wins here with the NFL disbanding the race norming algorithm. And they've also decided, you know, they're going to go back and retroactively look at all the players who may have been race normed. That's a win. But overall, you know, we just don't trust them because they're the ones who, you know, they were the architects of this side door that allowed them to get away with it for so long. So the proof is in the pudding. If they do this, that's great. My concern is that there'll be another side door because they are slick and smart. And to this point, Chris Seeger, who was supposed to be our representative, has been overpowered by the NFL.
So, Mary Claire, let me come to you on exactly that, that feeling of being over, or that reality of being overpowered by the NFL. Some were saying this even before the race norming became public about the idea of the $1 billion settlement in and of itself, that $1 billion sounds like a lot, but relative to what is made in the NFL, that it's actually kind of small potatoes. Is this settlement big enough?
Well, right now the settlement is uncapped. So that in some ways is what's led to this issue, I think, of the NFL appealing awards if they were not, quote, fully demographically normed, which means if they were not race normed. The settlement came about in 2013 through secret negotiations after hundreds of lawsuits had been filed against the NFL by former players who accused the NFL basically of fraud and said that they had hidden what they knew about the effect of repeated concussions and send people back out on the field. So rather than go to trial, it was a risk for players as well. So the two sides forged a settlement, which initially was capped at $765 million. The judge fairly quickly, within I believe a year or two by 2015, had realized that that was not going to be enough. And she really, you know, I think forced the NFL to uncap it. The NFL, of course, is footing the bill for the award fund. But because of that, the NFL started to become much more aggressive, appealing awards more frequently. And really, when only about 28% of the dementia claims were being leading to an award, and these are claims which doctors had determined that the person had a certain level of dementia, and yet 70% of the time they were being rejected, that is when I believe the lawyers started to look more closely at how they were scored. And I think to their surprise, realized that this race norming was occurring.
So, Mary Claire, are you saying the physicians were not aware that the race norming practice was happening?
I think they are. I think that it's actually up to them to do it. And again, the idea, I think physicians most often want to look holistically at a patient and, you know, bring in their education. In other words, is this what they're seeing, you know, representative of who the person was? What's interesting about this case is that I think Ken and others would argue, you know, correctly, that the NFL players, black, white, or other races, have more in common with each other than not, because most of them had 3 years of college. They may come from more similar than dissimilar backgrounds in some cases. But, you know, the whole thing was meant to be a crude proxy for socioeconomic levels. But here you have a group of men who have a more similar background, again, than not.
Mary Claire, that is so helpful, that reminder that race is a social construct. It's not norming based on blood type or some other kind of physiological reality. And in this case, right, there's every reason to think that the social grouping here is more relevant than any of the divides around race. So, Ken, I want to come back to you on this a bit, because the NFL is claiming that it's going to go back, review old claims. Do you think that's enough? Or are you and other retired players and families looking for something more?
Well, we think that's a step in the right direction. We are looking for more. We want, and I feel like if they don't provide us with all the demographic information of all the people who've been through the regimen of and all the testing to reveal what the true facts and the true numbers are, then we haven't really illuminated what they have done. And I believe if that information was in the NFL's favor, they would have released that information already. The NFL and their lawyers, their job is to reduce the exposure in the suit. I'm in the insurance industry. I work with big corporations as much as I can. And it's always a fight between the client and the insurance companies as to what they're going to cover. And if there is a side door somewhere, the insurance companies will exercise it. And given that the NFL, with Chris Seeger's capitulence, has put us in a terrible situation where we can't trust what they come up with at this point.
When you talk about that side door, those multiple side doors, the lack of trust, I'm wondering if any of that is deterring young people and maybe their families from entering the league.
Well, so it's really interesting. I talked to some, you know, very high powered folks at both the NFL and the NFLPA, and not to name names, but they say, you know, as long as they're poor folks, they're going to be kids playing football.
They call you all gladiators for a reason, right? That same idea of sort of how it works for the public entertainment.
Yes, yes. And we know it's a, you know, an extremely, you know, violent game. But you know, we know more about concussions now than we knew back when I played, and certainly prior to that in the 70s and 60s. So the concussion protocols are better. I worry now that they're going to make it more difficult for all players to qualify under the suit, leaving them another side door. It's with this case not being transparent, and I think Mary Claire can speak to, there will be more transparency, but with the way that the agreements were done prior to this, there was no transparency. So we don't really know what's being discussed.
So that transparency question, let me come to you, Mary Claire, because that's precisely what media, what reporting, what social movements are meant to do, is to bring some level of transparency to practices like this. What will you be keeping your eyes on as, you know, you hear Ken here sort of talking about the fear of another side door? How do you see your role in terms of reporting on this to, you know, to move towards practices of equity?
Right. Well, very interestingly, the players filed this suit in 2020 after their attempts to do it through the administrative process. Basically, the award fund had failed. And the judge dismissed the suit this year on procedural grounds. But again, amongst the action and petition drive and publicity that people like Ken and his wife have taken part in, the judge, in a very, very unusual way, after dismissing the suit, decided that it was very important and asked a magistrate to compile a report on it. And that report is now due Friday, this Friday. And that was sort of a new development. Initially, there was not a deadline for that report. And we are very much hoping Ken and others and the lawyers for the more of the Black players really want to see the data, the payout data by race, and see how often, what's the percentage of successful claims by Black players and versus white. And again, the NFL is now pledging to review those and correct anything that where a player did not get an award that he would have had he been white. But again, they will be fighting these claims probably because it's dollars and it's also reputational damage. But one note on that, if this settlement is likely to go beyond about $1 billion, they've paid out about $800 million so far. But, to put that in perspective, I believe the NFL just signed their latest multi-year TV contract for $113 billion. So the players would, I think, argue that they have the money to write the very serious brain injuries that people are suffering from.
And I am going to leave it on that idea of $113 billion television contract and a $1 billion settlement for the players. Mary Claire Dale, legal affairs writer for the Associated Press and a former Nieman Fellow, and Ken Jenkins, a former Washington running back. Thank you both so much for talking with us through this.
Thank you.
It's been great to be with you. Thank you.
Before I let Ken go, I did have to ask him to weigh in on another NFL-related matter. What to rename his former team, which is currently just going by the Washington Football Team.
That's really funny. I actually like the Red Wolves. If you could imagine sort of 70,000 people as the team comes on the field howling like a wolf.
I'm for that. I get that. I like that. Yeah.
I like the Red Wolves. I do.
Another show's wrapped, folks. Thanks as always for listening. Keep coming back all week because we're happy to have you with some of our favorite conversations of the year. And if you'd like to be a part of the show or you want to call us with show ideas or suggestions, you can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or record a voice memo and email it to us at takeawaycallers@gmail.com. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.